This has been quite a November weather-wise, hasn't it? And tell you what, it feels like we skipped November and December and sort of jumped right into January.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm not getting much of arguing from our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Great to have you with us, Steve.
Great to be here on this wintry day.
And John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and is on sabbatical this year, so it's good to see you.
Yeah, good to be back here today.
Yeah,
great snowy day.
Yeah, it's a great snowy day. And I'll tell you what, we'll give our listeners a chance to join in. What do you have for questions about the current weather or what might be in store for us this winter? Any interesting weather phenomena that you've noticed lately? We always get some great questions or comments about cool things that happen weather-wise. We'd certainly love to hear from you about that. And also photos. Go to our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. If you've got some great weather photos, we certainly would love to see them as well. And, guys, thanks so much for coming by. I'm guessing there are a lot of people listening who really want to know why it felt like January for the last couple of weeks.
Man, what a period of time. It was remarkable. Well, you know, at high latitudes in the Northern Hemisphere, Canadian archipelago north of the mainland in Canada, the sun hasn't been up since the end of September. So it's easy to get cold. You know, you get 24 hours of darkness. And that happens every year because that's controlled by the sun and the Earth's tilt and all that. But it depends on whether or not we ever see any of that cold air in the early part of the winter. It depends on the nature of the flow in the middle and higher latitudes of the atmosphere, on Earth, I mean. And this year we had an explosive event in the Gulf of Alaska in early November, and that triggered a giant wave that was able to go out to the high latitudes and scour that cold air out and dump it over eastern North America, and we got really cold early as a consequence.
And when you say explosive event, what do you mean by an explosive event?
We had a typhoon that recurved, and they do this all the time. Every fall they do this. It recurved, a pretty strong typhoon that hit Japan, recurved towards the North Pole in the western Pacific, and it redeveloped into a major storm in the middle latitudes and changed the complexion of the flow in such a way as to scour out cold air over northwest Canada and drop it on us.
Oh, man.
So does northwest Canada have snowfall on the ground?
They have some snow, but the really unusual snowy spot is Siberia this year. Now, not unusual that they get snow, but they have an unusually early start. So it's been very, very cold in the eastern hemisphere at the same latitudes as our northwest Canada. And that was part of the issue here, too, it looks like. But there is snow in northwest Canada, yes.
So that would help. But usually you get a lot of snow to help get that air really cold.
Yeah, and to keep it cold as it heads southward.
Keep it cold, yeah. Well, here we are out east. Poor Buffalo, New York. People have been hit with, what is it, seven feet
of snow in some spots.
Seven feet of snow in a really short period of time, and you hear this term lake effect snow, and people are certainly familiar with it, and people who live near Lake Superior regularly get that too. What is lake effect snow really? How does that form?
So fundamentally, it's, you know, when you bring cold air coming out of the Arctic, as we experienced here, and you bring it over a warmer water, that enhances the evaporation of the water off the lakes up into the clouds. And if you have the dynamics forming to get the clouds built, that provides the moisture for the precipitation when that air mass comes and hits landfall and generates it.
It's really, and the combination, too, of the availability of moisture, as Steve points out, and how warm the lake surface is compared to adjacent land surfaces. Once that cold air moves over that warm, it's like moving over a hot plate. And something that we refer to as stratification or stability is completely upset from its normal situation in the atmosphere, and you get freely convective clouds that form, and you get a lot of condensation and creation of ice. That's what's really going on there.
Yeah,
when you watch the radar images, the precipitation was just going right down the entire length of Erie, all the way down, just getting more and more intense, and then it hits Buffalo.
And it was stationary.
It was just in the middle of the lake all the time.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
And then up in Superior, in that area, you know, there's a little bit of elevation to help support that, too.
That's
I'm not
right.
sure if buffalo has that.
No, that's not a big
orographic
region.
You have to go further
region.
Inland before you get the Catskills and stuff like that.
Yeah. Do you need a superior-sized lake to get the lake effects? You know, how big a lake do you need?
You really need the right wind direction, and Steve's mentioned this many times before, called a fetch. How long does the air that's going to end up generating the snow cross the lake? So a big lake, almost every wind direction creates a large fetch. But on some of the smaller ones, if you get a wind direction like along Lake Erie, this was perfectly along the long axis of Lake Erie. And so it was the maximal amount of evaporation that could possibly occurred. And then the consequence was historic snow.
Yeah, absolutely. Does the ocean have that kind of effect too, or is it?
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah, you bet.
You must have had this in Long Island too, right, when you were growing up?
Except generally where we live, the storms are moving out to sea as opposed when they come up the coastline, then you would get dumped on.
We occasionally in New England had really big ocean effect. It's the same idea because the water is warm.
Waters.
And we'd have these big ocean effect enhancements of broad-scale snowfalls where I lived in the northeast part of Massachusetts. It was great.
I had an urban and regional planner on the show once who said one of the turnpikes that was built, if they'd had just built it about 10 miles further south, they would have eliminated the lake effect.
Yeah.
And they could have done it, but they didn't consider.
Interesting.
That was not considered when that turnpike was built.
Wow. Yeah, actually, I-90 goes right to right by Lake Erie and Lake Michigan, well. Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. They've been 10 or maybe 20 miles. I don't remember. He said that a little further south would have
That's saved. A really good point. It must be 90.
I'm remembering now, you know, because we did a lot of driving back home, back to New York. And when you hit just south of Lake Erie and the ice on the roads would go way up.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's interesting.
Is there such a thing as a lake effect rain?
Yeah, there is. It's less common because when the air temperature is warm enough to not produce snow, then the difference in the air temperature compared to the lake temperature is not large enough to have this free convective motion, this almost boiling pot of water on the lake.
Okay.
So that boiling effect, that convective effect, is enhanced when the air is cold, and consequently, most of the time that precip falls is snow.
Yeah, and you see that around Lake Mendota, too. When you get a cold air mass come in over the warmer lake around this time in particular, it gets very turbulent.
That's right.
And that's that convection getting worked up.
Yeah.
Talking with John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our weather guys today. Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Talking climate and weather with them. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Post question, comment, and weather photo right there. Wayne in River Falls, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I kind of have a different question. We've had cold weather up here in River Falls, too. But I grew up in a little town called Rio. I'm sure you might know it, in North Madison.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And right about between now and Christmas time, we always had the kind of weather that we had up here the last 2 days, real warm and moist and humid air. And for as long as I can remember, it's always happened, and we used to call it case weather. We grew tobacco in southern Wisconsin, and to get the weather or the leaves off the tobacco, you'd open up the louvers in the tobacco shed and have the moisture go in so you could handle the plants again and strip the tobacco plants. So,
Wayne, I did a lot of that myself when I was a kid.
Yeah,
actually, I stripped a lot of tobacco when I was a kid for neighbors who raised tobacco in the Cottage Grove, Edgerton areas.
It's not much fun, is it?
No.
It's work. I got it. Right.
Well,
work
not,
is good for
not
you.
Not much fun alone, but if you've got four or five people, you get talking and just sort of, you know, it's like a little knitting bee or something.
So the moisture keeps the leaves from getting brittle?
Yes.
Is that what it does?
Well, the moisture comes in, and they're so brittle before that, you can't handle it. It just crumbles.
It crumbles.
You open up the tobacco louvers and moisture goes in and you can strip them off.
So the foggy weather we've had over the weekend was good weather for that.
Yeah, and you know,
does that happen every year? It seems like it has.
I think that's a fairly common thing for us in the mid to late fall. And the reason I think is, if I had to make a guess off the top of my head, which I'm in fact doing, is that this is the time of year, and everybody would notice this and agree right away, is that when the storms are more powerful, like the one we're going to get today, you'll see some winds this evening that we haven't really seen very much in the late summer and early part of the fall. And this is the beginning of a really stormy season. One of the consequences of a more energetic set of storms that kind of come traipsing through here for the next couple of months is that you end up with bigger changes in air masses associated with those storms. And so on the east side of these storms, like we had on the weekend, a developing feature in the central U.S., it's really warm and moist. And then on the backside, like today and tomorrow, it'll be cold and sometimes snowy like today. And so you have these big transitions. But half of those transitions, of course, are transitions to warm and moist. And sometimes people say, you know, unusually warm and moist for late November or early December. So I think it is fairly common that you get a couple of episodes like this at this time of year. And I think that's the underlying reason. It gets more stormy now.
You only need a day or two, but you usually get it.
So. Yeah, you do.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you very much. I can even remember January's where you'd have a couple of days, and that's exactly when the tobacco got stripped.
Yeah, and it's related to the storminess of the wintertime, high amplitude storm.
It must occur, right? Otherwise, economically, that crop would have just.
Oh yeah, it has to happen. It has to happen.
Right?
It has to happen, or you're not going to be able to. Strip your tobacco. That is for sure. I'm not sure if it's why it's called case weather, other than you're casing, kind of, you're baling tobacco.
Right, yeah.
You're not really
putting it in a case like whiskey or anything.
No, I'm actually trying to remember now, but it's just a paper kind of bundle that you wind up with that weighs maybe 50 to 70 pounds, something like that.
And then you ship it off to
And then it goes, yeah, then they're stacked, and actually... This is a total aside, but actually it was stacked, and then buyers would come and take a look at your tobacco and offer, offer you whatever they were going to offer you, and you had your choice. I guess you could turn it down, but then where do you sell it?
Yeah, right.
Otherwise, but that's pretty much how it worked.
Mm.
And somebody's probably going to call and say, Mueller, you don't know what you're talking about. I was a pretty young guy at the time. there's probably a whole new system now.
But they are going to know what you were smoking.
Has nothing to do with it. Oh, man. Jeff in Warrens, Wisconsin. Thanks a lot for calling. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, guys. Hey, question for you.
Yep.
Up here in Warrens, well, I used to work for an outdoor place. We sell plants and stuff like that. We used to ask them where they used to live, especially up in this, because Warren seems to have its own little microsystem because of the sand and the water and the iron in the soil and all that. And I live here now, and the storms, thunderstorms during the summer seem to be worse. The wind and the cold seems to be like a natural attraction right here.
As compared to how far away?
Oh, you can go, 10, 15 miles away, and it's completely different.
Completely different. Okay.
And, we used to ask them where they were planting it, just because it just seems like that. It's just, is it because of the bog? And the moisture in the soil or the iron that's here?
Those are all interesting questions, and I'm going to have our weather guys ponder it a bit. And we're taking a quick look at the news weather, find out what else is in store for us. And Jeff will be back with the answer to your question right after the news. Stay with us. Never a shortage of things to talk about with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin. They have lots of good information to talk about. We've visited about lake effect snow. We can talk about what's coming up for winter and certainly answer your questions as well. John's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW. And thanks for coming by again, John. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, yeah. It's great to be here.
And Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Steve, always a pleasure.
It's fun to be here. Love this show.
And here we had Jeff from Warrens, Wisconsin. And for those who don't know where Lawrence, Wisconsin is. I think it's kind of between Wisconsin Rapids and La Crosse, somewhere in that area. Especially closer to La Crosse, I think, actually.
It's in a low. If you look at the geological map of Wisconsin, it's more in a low-lying area.
It's cranberries.
It's cranberry area. It's right. You go to Warren's for the Cranberry Festival. And so the fact that he was saying, as Jeff was saying, that he thought it would be windier than the area around it. I mean, if it's open and flat, cranberry fields, there's not much growing in them in terms of trees and things. I could see how that could pick up the wind. And then also with the other areas around it being a slightly higher elevation, the colder air would tend to pool into that area, I would think. That would also seem to make it cooler.
Yeah, so there would be a lot of local effects from all of those circumstances. I think he's right on about that.
So you're right, Jeff. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. He said, it seems like it's a difference. And our weather guys say, yep, you're right. There is a little microsystem going on around Warren. And that's probably true, and you're going to find that in other areas of the state, too.
Yeah, that's probably right. And Warren has a special set of characteristics with higher elevation all around it. That can probably get it cooler than it would be to many of the surrounding communities.
Mm-hmm. Tom in Cedarburg. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I've got a question. I had heard on, actually, NPR in the summer or fall of 13 that the solar scientists were worried about the sun, and I thought, what are they talking about? And as it turns out, the solar spot activity is about half of what it should be, and we're supposed to be at around the peak time. And I've done some research, and when there's less energy from the sun, there tends to be cooler, wetter weather, and I'm wondering if that has something to do with the weather we're experiencing.
Yeah, right. The sunspot cycle, I say that more slowly, does go through a cycle. That's why we call it the sunspot cycle, of 11 years cycle. It kind of goes around,
okay.
And then it flips polarity, and so oftentimes you'll also hear it as a 20-year cycle. And in terms of the number of sunspot cycles in this current cycle, the number of sunspots is lower than what we've normally been seeing over the last few years. Maybe in the past, when it reached its peak, it was around 150. Now we're talking about 100 or so. So, there has been some interest in that in terms of the solar scientists trying to explain why that's the case. As it turns out, the number of sunspots indicates solar activity, which then influences our upper atmosphere. In particular, things like getting the northern lights and aspects like that.
Yeah.
But nobody's been able to connect the sunspot cycle to other weather cycles in the troposphere down where we live in terms of temperatures or humidities or winds or things like that. So we haven't figured out what, if any, that connection is, although we certainly see it in the upper atmospheres.
Yeah.
Sure. If I can make one more point.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, in my research, it showed back from like 1650 to 1710, after the telescope was invented by Galileo, that they were watching the sun. And in that time span, the sunset activity almost flatlined, and it just stayed calm. And the effect on the Earth in that 70-year period was very strong. It cooled down quite a bit, and there was a lot more storms and bad weather, especially colder weather. And like in Europe, some of the Ice Age glaciers were starting to come back, and there was a lot of disease and pestilence during that time. If you'd want to look that up, you'd...
No, yeah, when I was saying the numbers in comparison to recent events, I was thinking of the last 2 to 3 cycles, so going back 40, 50 years or so. You're right, during the... it's called the Maunder Minimum.
Yeah,
there were no sunspots, or very few of them, and for a long time period. The connections to what was going on Earth, again, still, you can see that there is a correlation, but actually the causation is still something we need
to
figure out.
Tricky, because I think now, it seems to me that the sunspot science that was kind of flourishing in the 50s and 60s seemed to kind of stop as soon as satellites were up there actually measuring the radiation from the sun.
Right.
And isn't it a fraction of a percentage that an active or inactive cycle really provides to
the atmosphere? It's a small amount. And actually, when you have sunspots, which are the dark things, You also have bright spots that accompany them, which are called faculae, I think. Or
I know that word.
And so actually, when you have a high number of sunspots, a number of dark blemishes, the actual output of the sun actually goes up.
Because of these
other energetic things that accompany the dark spots.
And you know what the fraction is of output?
It's generally small.
Less than a percent, right?
Yeah.
So that's what always makes me wonder if there really is a connection. I know there's these famous correlations like Tom's talking about, but there's so many things that can influence the way the atmosphere behaves. And when you're talking about a fraction of a percent of solar energy, it's likely something else is at least contributing in the same direction.
Mm. Yeah.
It's that high energy stuff that's important for generating the normal lights and the impact on the magnetosphere and things like that.
There we go. Thank you very much, Tom, for calling. I appreciate your call. We had an email from Bill in Madison. Said, if you watch the radar loop from NOAA, you'll see that we in Dane County were almost out of the strongest snowfall. There's more snow behind us, but it's much lighter. We've been predicted to get around 3 to 5 inches. By what the radar shows, that isn't really likely now. You guys have said that we're getting better at 10-day forecasts, but this morning we heard 3 to 5 inches. We might not even get an inch.
Day's not over yet. That's what I would say. This is a storm that's getting itself organized right now.
Okay.
So as that happens, you get a variety of bands of precipitation that will start become part of that complexion of that storm as it evolves. When it really does get itself better organized late today, especially into the early and later part of the evening, I think there'll be a pretty consistent band of snow that's likely to be north of us here in Dane County. I think the heaviest snow will be north of us, but we'll still be in a position to accumulate snow for a number of hours through the night, maybe into the early part of the morning. So this is the first advance artillery barrage of snowflakes. It's not the main battle, I would say. So
all right.
Don't give up on that forecast yet.
Okay. There you go.
Darn, because I'm not, I don't want to be shoveling my
I know. I'm not thrilled about it either, but I think it's coming.
Right.
You can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Richard in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have the text, Severe and Hazardous Weather by Robert Walsh and Shelvo. At any rate, I can't find in there anywhere a reference to a polar vortex. Yet I hear it all the time.
Yeah.
We're in the grips of a polar vortex.
John's got a comment.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You read it in the newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. It's in the media. This is a word. It's a term of art. It used to be a term of art amongst those of us who study weather systems in the middle latitudes. And so, as a consequence, I don't think you find it in introductory textbooks. This is a very good point you're making, Richard. There's no reason for an introductory textbook to make mention of the polar vortex. What it is as the hemisphere gets colder in the wintertime, for our wintertime, you have a stronger horizontal temperature contrast from the high to mid latitudes. That is what drives the jet stream circulation, and so the vortex expands. And the circulation around the hemisphere is counterclockwise, so we call it a vortex. And that expands and contracts with the cooling and then the warming of the hemisphere as the year goes on. Last winter, for reasons that are are certainly unscientific and hard to figure out, the media jumped all over this word. They must have talked to somebody who said, like I'm talking to you, there's a polar vortex that sets up every winter. Somebody must have just taken that and run downfield with it. And they it's like a Melvin Gordon 99-yard. they broke away from everybody, and now that word is all over the place. But you're right, you're not going to find it in introductory textbooks because it's just not as big a word as it should be.
Ah. Except the introductory textbook that John Knox and I wrote, where we talk about it, but with relation to the ozone hole, to the development of the polar vortex over the southern pole.
That's right. I take that back. Yeah. Steve's right. And that's an appropriate way to talk about it.
Right. Yeah. And a shout out to John, who's an alumnus of ours, for winning Georgia State Professor of the Year.
Ah, yeah. Right. Good for him. Yeah. That's
all
great.
Right. Richard, there you have it. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
Get our book. You clearly got to get another introductory book.
What's the title of your book, by the way?
Meteorology, Understanding the Atmosphere. Not very creative, but descriptive.
Parentheses and the polar vortex.
And the polar vortex.
Yeah. Don't miss our comment on the polar vortex.
That's the byline.
You need a blurb on the book.
We talk about the polar vortex as it should be talking about.
Right.
Oh, man. There we go. Thanks, Richard. Don in Tomahawk. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I really appreciate your show. I am a meteorologist, or was anyway. I graduated in 62. My mentor was Heinz Littau.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Talk about micrometeorology. Mr.
Yes,
expert.
And I spent a partial career as a Navy meteorologist. I've got a couple of questions and then a little humorous anecdote. I watch TV, and I see these people talking about their particular numerical model that they're using for forecasting. At my brother-in-law's in Dallas, the TV announcer uses three different numerical models, mm-hmm. and he picks the forecast he wants. How, on the formulation of these numerical models for forecasting, how good are they on a macro scale?
That's where they perform their very best, Don, actually. It's when you get into the details of where and exactly how much precipitation and when it's going to fall that they still struggle because it's very mesoscale. But on the large scale, they are really, really good.
And that's why using multiple ones is good because they give you different, I don't want to say choices, but different options based on that particular model's features of where the snow will occur.
Where the mesoscale stuff will show up. Exactly right.
Oh, very good. Just a quick little humorous anecdote. My neighbor here grew up, she died 7 years ago. Old lady grew up in Spirit Falls, Wisconsin, and she said they could never plant tomatoes before the 1st of July because it froze all the time. They were kind of in a blueberry bog. And I asked her, did you ever have any ripe tomatoes? And she says, no.
No.
Wow.
But she planted
them
nonetheless.
Them every year. That's optimism, Don, with a capital O.
Oh, it's a great story, Don. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for your program.
Yeah, I really appreciate your comment. Yeah, you know, when it's like farming and gardening, you know, you just got to keep hoping.
You got to keep hoping, and they'll taste really good if they do ripen.
That's right.
Rusty in Stevens Point. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate you guys' show. Well, earlier this year, I was listening to the show, and the guys mentioned that the chances of us having a winter like last year was very, very, very slim. And I realized, I understand when you were talking about the storm that kind of threw this weather at us now, but how's the rest of the winter going to look? Is it going to be as bad as last year? Because right now it's sure looking
bad. Yeah. Who said that, Rusty? What are you talking about? That must have been Larry.
Yeah, Larry, that's right.
No, all right, so let me be the first to enter the fray here. I love your comment. You're right on. I've been telling people now who I see frequently, so far this winter is looking a lot like last winter. However, in Madison, last November, we were only a half a degree below normal, or even less than that, if I remember right. And right now, we're running about 6 degrees below normal. So actually, the start may give you a feel that it's the same. I think it's more extreme this year. So that's that story. And then the second part is, I think the wintertime forecast is still about 50-50 for colder than normal.
Right. Yeah.
And so that doesn't sound like it's going to be a repeat of next year. But, you know, that's not done in the same way that tomorrow's forecast is done. Either in the newspaper or on television. It's much more statistical. I would still confidently say I don't think we're going to see the same kind of winter this year that we saw last winter, but it's certainly easy to understand why people would say, what are you talking about?
So you're confident now. You used to be assured that it wasn't going to...
Oh, yeah, I don't want to nitpick. I'll still say assured. I am assured it won't be as bad.
There you go. There you go, Rusty. Thanks a lot for calling. We had a Facebook comment from Lois. Within the last couple of weeks, can't remember the date, La Crosse was getting unexpected snow. The meteorologist called it river effect snow, similar to lake effect. The weather system that was present and the Mississippi's river's warmth.
Hmm.
River effect? Well, the Mississippi I mean, the Mississippi River gets pretty wide in spots, but...
Right, and you can get a long fetch along it if you set up the right kind of wind field. You can go right up the river, and so maybe that happens there. I know a couple of people at La Crosse, one of the most recent hirees is probably the smartest guy I've had in my research group. I got a golden age right now. He's really good, so they know what they're doing up there. And if they say that, then there must be a local effect that really does show up once in a while.
Yeah, and I would think you need the winds to be... you know, from a certain direction consistently for
that's
a while
right.
to really yeah. know, to start to see that accumulated effect.
Right. It's probably rare, but it probably does happen yeah. occasionally. Interesting.
Jane in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have approximately a 10-foot by 10-foot pond in Door County that's about a third covered by a deck. When we had that torrential storm this summer, 5 inches of rain, and many people claim 7 inches at their house, I expected in the morning when I looked out at my pond to see it overflowing, which it has done in the past when we had a lot of rain because it has no outlet. Hmm. Instead, my water lily leaves were laying over the edge of the pot. About 4 inches, maybe even 5 inches, of water was missing from the pond. The pond had dropped the water level. And I had to run my hose at full blast for an hour and 20 minutes to replace that water. Where did my water go?
Wow.
My first reaction was, do you have kids who will sneak and play in your pond?
No. And I thought perhaps a raccoon had punctured the lining. It has a rubber lining.
Oh, that, yeah.
Right, leaking. I put the water in to try to save my water lilies during the day when I went to work. It has held that water ever since. Yeah. It wasn't a leak in the membrane.
And, you know, I was wondering about winds being, perhaps blowing
it. It was very windy. Is it possible to have a water spout on such a small pond?
How big is the pond?
Approximately 10 feet by 10 feet. Well,
I wouldn't think you would.
And a third of it is covered.
I wouldn't think you'd have a water spout, but you could, you know, you get downdrafts in some of these thunderstorms that if it hit exactly the right spot, it could just blow some of that water right out of there. It's not impossible. It's very, seems unlikely, but it's not impossible.
But even that, you might see damage in plants nearby
pushed down
as well.
That's very odd.
There's walkway around the three sides that are still exposed, and the deck covers the fourth side.
Very
so there wouldn't have been wash away on an edge, if that's what you're implying.
Mm-hmm. And you have and it's a rubber line. And my first guess was, well, maybe there's a sinkhole underneath or something because of all the water adjacent, but it couldn't be that. Wow.
No, I don't think so. Oh, and you were my last hope. I've asked so many people, and I thought the weather guys will know the answer.
Is there a possibility the liner was breached and then resealed itself?
Hmm.
Maybe folded over on itself or something?
Yeah, folded over. Somehow.
Oh, what with that weight of water sitting on it, I don't see
how that'd be hard,
move. And I wish they healed themselves.
Yeah, I'm sure it would make it a lot easier to have it, right?
There'd be a lot more ponds in people's backyards.
Wouldn't have to worry about the raccoons then.
That sure is weird.
Well,
I don't have the answer. Oh, dear.
Well, Jane, I think you're right on about this localized water spout. It might not be that kind of a high-profile phenomenon, but something related could very well be what happened. Just blew the water out of there.
Yeah, the wind, and coming from the right direction, too.
Right. Like
maybe you haven't seen it come from a particular direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's as good a guess as
for you.
I'm still going with the kids, you know, maybe neighborhood kids coming in and splashing around.
Thanks, Jane. Rick in Monona, hi, thanks for calling.
Hello, I am enjoying your show, and I had a question that's kind of been in my mind for a while, and that's there seems like there's so many weather forecasters out there now. And that it actually leads to, rather than clarity, a lot of confusion on the part of us out in the general public. What I'm getting at is I look at the newspaper, and the newspaper has a prediction on what the weather's going to be. And then I hear on the radio some other forecast, and then television has another one. I'm wondering if that's kind of a problem for other people and for you that, there seems like there's just so many voices out there telling you what the weather's going to be, and a lot of times they conflict.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Rick. I think part of that conflict arises from the shelf life of certain of these forecasts. I think when you're putting a newspaper together, you have to have your forecast several hours in advance of publication and distribution, whereas on the radio and television, you have the opportunity to have an update that's almost up to the minute if there's an active weather situation going on in your area. So the consequence is, I think the television and the radio, the more immediate media, are going to usually have a slightly different answer than the newspaper in an ongoing weather event. I think the snow event today will be a classic example of that. So if you're asking me where I would go as the weather is going on, I'm always going to go to the more immediate media, radio or television.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I would still think, I mean, if you went in our building right now and asked yesterday, you know, so these are all the researchers who are doing it. How much snowfall we're going to get?
Oh, yeah.
I bet you were to get a range from nothing to 8 inches.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing thing.
So it's just that uncertainty yet still that we're dealing with.
Right. And as something's ongoing outside, you're blending real observations with very short-term forecasts to try and make sense of what happens in the next 12 hours. And you don't have that luxury 2 days before the event. And that's pretty much what the newspaper is going to be able to tell you about, right, is 2 days ahead of time. So it's a disadvantage to them.
And so when I want to know when the snowfall is, I go to John.
I call John up.
I just call John. Yeah, what's going to happen?
And then he acts exactly in the opposite way.
Right.
Well, I tell you, actually, I found our morning paper. I always look at the morning paper, and it gives me the temperature. You know, it's pretty accurate on the temperatures.
Yep. It's the precept that's the hardest forecast.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
But the temperatures, I mean, I want to know
usually
the temperature, and they're right on target.
That's right.
Well, guys, this is, as always, a great pleasure. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I know everybody else did, too. You'll be back the last Monday. Will it be the last Monday?
It'll be the last Monday.
Yeah, that's right.
The year.
Of the year, too.
Yeah. Oh,
my goodness. Seems hard to believe, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. Where did it go? Where did the time go? Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. John, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And guess what? They'll be back the last Monday of 2014. Tomorrow we have some great consumer protection advice from Sandy Chalmers and Michelle Reinen. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.